Good morning, everyone. Shelley just informed me this morning that we're up to 258 registrants for this year. That's awesome. Awesome turnout for everybody. I hope that everyone enjoyed last evening's opening reception and affiliate member displays. Thank you to Vermeer Corporation for sponsoring that event, and of course, thank you to the affiliate members who participated. Also, thank you to T.H. Glennon for sponsoring the grab-and-go breakfast this morning. We have an exciting day ahead filled with knowledgeable speakers, important industry topics, and of course, our keynote speaker later today with Rudy. I can't wait. I hope that everyone can stick around for all the festivals, all the festivities that we have, the sessions that we have scheduled for today. And of course, don't forget about the President's Happy Hour later this evening, featuring, of course, cocktails and hors d'oeuvres. Seems like it's a reoccurring theme, which is great. A roaming magician and a chance to win our grand prize. Now, let's kick things off with our first session of the day. The future of raw material. This session is spearheaded by Sean Martini, Director of Bagging Operations for Britton Industries, and Grant Williamson, Chief Operating Officer at Austin Wood Recycling. These two gentlemen bring a wealth of experience to the industry, and they will share with us firsthand experiences of sourcing raw materials across two very different regions of the United States, Texas and the Northeast. They'll explore the unique challenges and opportunities currently facing our industry and offer insights to what the future may hold for our ever-changing market. Please join me in welcoming Sean and Grant. Gentlemen, thank you.
The first thing I want to do is thank Bob and Shelley and Tom for putting on a great show. Everybody hear me okay? Many of us in the room, we attend lots of different conferences and shows throughout the year, and I can confidently say that this is my favorite one every year. And I was trying to think last night why that is, and I think it's because the MSC has figured out a way to get a lot of decision makers in one place, and I think the quality of the show is really unmatched. And I'll give you a really good example of that. So right now, PAC Expo is happening in Vegas, and a lot of people go to both shows. And I know there's exhibitors here that left that show to be at this show. According to ChatGPT, that show costs about $20 million to organize, and there's about 100,000 people that attend that show. So to have exhibitors leave that show to come to this show, I think illustrates perfectly the quality of this particular show. I've been in the industry here for about 15 years, and sometimes I wonder if there's, it's probably not good to admit this, but I wonder if there's anything left to learn. Well, I can assure you, if you decide to stand behind this podium and give a speech, you will learn a lot. Nobody in this room is going to learn more about this topic than I have learned over the past few months with Sean and Jim and Britton Industries. I got to visit their place. And lastly, I need to issue an apology. I'm sorry that I'm not David Crow or Rudy Rudiger. I really need you guys to lower your expectations a little bit. This isn't a sexy topic, okay? I think you'll find that I'm presenting a problem. It's certainly a problem for us, but it's I think it's a problem for others as well. And I think Sean and his team, Sean's going to be presenting one potential solution to that problem. I hope you like it. I hope it's informative. But if you don't, it's really Shelley and Tom's fault. So I didn't pick the topic. I don't know the results of this survey. I'm going to find it out when I ask the question, but show of hands, how many of you have at least one mobile grinding crew and perform grinding operations for other recyclers? Raise your hand. Okay, so we've got a number of you. Okay, so are any of you going to be up in that revenue stream this year compared to last year? Raise your hand if you're going to be up. Two or three. Okay, four. All right. We are not going to be up. We're going to be flat or down. And that that poses a problem for us. And I'll try to explain why. So for us in Texas, it's been booming. So there's a slowdown in land development, and that's been reducing our feedstock. C&D material needs to be discussed. There's some industry and regulatory implications that go along with that. So will the decline in development reduce brush supply? The answer from me is yes. For us, it's reducing it. Will C&D material be needed to fill the gap? Probably. Or other waste streams, as Sean mentioned. And then what are the regulatory implications for that? A little bit about our company. We were founded in 87, 38 years of continuous operations. Primary feedstock is green waste from clearing, grinding, and then, of course, brush tipping through the gate. Operations, we have two sites in DFW, two sites in Austin, two sites in Houston. Vertically integrated, our company was born out of the field grinding and clearing world. And so the bagging operations are a result of having to get rid of the material, like many of my competitors and many of the people that are in this industry. And one of my favorite stories that I love to tell about our company is that our owner, when he first got his first store with Home Depot well over 20 years ago, and he would go down on the weekends and buy his own bags back to make it look like that there would be returning product. So they would give us more stores because we had to get rid of the material, you know? So we do a lot of bagged sales now, but really we come from the construction world, which is, it ebbs and flows, you know, it has ups and downs. Produce mulch, compost, soil blends, the vast majority of what we do is mulch. Key partnerships with municipalities, contractors, state agencies, TxDOT, a lot of cities, a lot of landfills, a lot of dirt work guys. Of course, landfill diversion, carbon reduction, soil health improvement are a focus for us because that's the industry we're in, right? We're taking what used to be garbage and turning it into something useful. Our owner's not been shy of investing in our company over the years. It's as many of you know, this is a very, very capital intensive endeavor that we're trying to succeed at, and it can be very, very costly. But if you don't do it, you get left behind. So I want to give you some numbers here, kind of lifting up my skirt a little bit. But over the past 3 years, you can see we've taken in about 7.8 million cubic yards of material, and that's a combination of first grind and tipping at the gate. And you can see there that it's declining, which is concerning. Because we've got 12 automated bagging lines, we've got to feed those beasts, and as this goes down, we start to look around and figure out how we're going to fill the bag. And lumber is only—it's a little less than 1% of our total intake. And so this—and when I say first grind, you know, we don't—it's hard. It was hard to get these numbers because we don't keep very good track of the material coming off the jobs that are coming back to our facilities. But we are, as of about a year and a half ago, we had 27 Diamond Z grinders, and we pared that down quite a bit, and we only have about 17 or 18 now we've disposed of and retired and sold off a few of those older units. But part of the reason we did it was because we're just not doing as much field grinding as we historically have done. Brush intake trends, so you can see here going back to 22. We're looking at 3 million down to 2.1, over 10.8 million cubic yards processed since 22. We are a large-scale recycler, but the raw material is greatly affected by seasonal changes, right? We had some of you guys from Texas know we had a big freeze a couple years ago that was good for his boon. You know, it was great for us because we got a bunch of material in, but you can see it didn't really affect our numbers that much. I mean, that's kind of scary that we had that big of an influx from the freeze and we still didn't make up all the difference. The declining intake underscores the long-term feedstock pressure. as land development slows. So, but even at reduced levels, intake volumes still represent a massive landfill diversion and sustain our core product streams. Texas Triangle is the fastest growing mega region in the U.S. DFW, Houston, Austin, San Antonio, there's about 21 million people there, expecting about 10 million more people by 2045. So that's a very rapid expansion that puts a big strain on infrastructure, right? The land, water sources, roads. I probably complain about traffic every single day of my life. It's I'm in Houston, Austin, or Dallas pretty much every week. And for some reason, we just keep wanting to have construction projects and just make it really difficult to move around the cities, you know. But it's because of the growth. So land trends data shows 95% of development occurs at the periphery. So we're talking about urban sprawl. One of my favorite memes about Houston, I lived in Houston for 9 years. I live in Dallas now, but Houston is an hour from Houston. Houston isn't an hour from Houston. It's massive. And DFW is the same. It's huge. So there's now a policy push for more compact mixed-use infill growth to preserve land and the infrastructure that's already there. There's already water lines. There's already utilities. We need to have a little bit higher density in city limits or closer to city centers so that we're not going, you know, 3 hours round trip to make deliveries and these things. That our industry is heavily dependent on freight. So the weight to value ratio of what we sell is not favorable. We're not selling microchips that we can send $10 million worth of microchips on a truckload. We're sending a few hundred dollars worth of material on a truckload, you know, so that makes it difficult because it affects our margins quickly. This gives you an idea sort of the acreage that we've lost to development. And I'm not up here saying development's a bad thing. Don't get me wrong. I'm just saying there's an impact on the state. So 1.8 million acres lost just from 17 to 22. So what's happening is there's fewer larger landowners. And so that's changing the land clearing dynamics for our company and our competitors. So conversion mainly to urban and suburban use, that it reduces feedstocks because you're just not going to get the same volume. You know, you clearing 100 acres, you're going to get a lot of material, right? If you're clearing an acre in town that doesn't have mature trees on it, you're just not going to get the same volume. So there's a reduced large-scale land clearing, and it's having an impact. From 2001 to 16, 95% of new development in the Texas Triangle occurred in metro periphery, so urban sprawl. Growth dominated by low-density sprawl, suburbs, big box retail, parking lots, highways. Texas spends less per household on infrastructure initially, but consumes more land per capita. Everything's bigger in Texas, right? I mean, the McMansions and the stadiums, and which I drove by Allen, their football stadium, a few weeks ago, and it looks like a pro stadium. So how has our brush intake trended with suburban expansion versus infill growth? You already saw that. Are there signs sprawl is slowing? Yes, we see it. I've asked some of my competitors. I mean, Tim, are you guys up this year in field grinding? No. Yeah, nobody is. You know, there's a lot of factors that go into that. Rates, the economy, for better or for worse, Trump. I mean, there's tariffs. There's a million different things. But we've been on a tear. Texas has been on a tear, particularly for a couple decades. And we've all sort of tailored our businesses to cater to that growth. And so now we're having to stop for a second. And I think this topic was brought to me back in January or February. And I was like, oh, that's relevant. And over the past 8 months, it's become really relevant to us. So I'm glad we're talking about it. So what's our exposure to periphery versus core development? Loss of farmland, ecosystem service loss, reduced flood control, carbon storage, biodiversity, San Antonio River Basin rangelands declined 65% in 15 years, urban land grew 29%. We've had, just name the issue, we've had it, flooding in Houston. I was there during Harvey. that has everything to do with development. And I don't want to say haphazard development, but there's no zoning in Houston. So it's kind of the wild, wild west when it comes to building. I was involved in some apartment multifamily construction projects there, and it was kind of shocking to me how easy it was to just build something. Because when you introduce an impervious cover, that water has to go somewhere. So what are the brush supply losses tied to land conversion? Well, there's obviously a permanent loss of vegetation. You clear it once, it's gone, right? So you're depending on urban brush is going to be a lot lighter, and there's not going to be as many mature trees. It's going to be contaminated. There's issues with that. There's fewer large clearing jobs now overall. Now you're going to have some anomalies. We've had some solar jobs, and we've had some large scale DFW, airport. We've had some large jobs this year, but historically it's not been an anomaly to have hundreds of acres of clearing and grinding to do on a job for us. And now it's rare. I would say rare. I can only remember a few, looking at my colleague over here. I can only remember a few, 100 plus clearing and grinding jobs that we've done this year. Probably there's more, but it's definitely reducing. So there's a fragmentation, for smaller parcels that reduces efficiency of collection. So, I mean, you can imagine if you're mobilizing a grinder, an excavator, a track loader, or a front end loader with a low boy, you have a fixed cost there of, pick a number. I don't know. Everybody has a different number, $5,000, $10,000. It costs money to get the machines out there. So if you're going to go out there and do 2 acres of clearing and grinding, that cuts into your margin a lot. If you're doing 100 acres, who cares about the mob? I mean, it's just a small piece of it. But what this is doing is it's changing the landscape of our margins and what our business model is, and we're having to adapt to that. So we have a greater reliance on storm debris, municipal contracts, and now, we're talking about C&D. So land clearing has historically supplied large volumes of brush. If sprawl slows, feedstock losses will appear first at the edges. Fragmentation of densely treated acreage increases sourcing costs and reduces efficiency. And then, of course, a loss of land also reduces buffer zones and secondary wood waste streams. So the cost to procure raw feedstocks historically for us versus now, it's going up, right? Everything's more expensive. I mean, I don't know who's bought a grinder recently, but it's twice as much as it was 15 years ago. A track loader used to cost $400,000, now it's $650,000. I mean, it's just everything's going up, and guess what you're not paying more for at Home Depot or Lowe's? You're not paying more for mulch. So somebody's eating that cost, right? And it's us. Quality differences between peripheral brush versus urban tree waste. There's some net effects of quality and cost on our current business model, right? So in the past, we'd get large volumes of clean brush. We're very particular and picky. Our operators are good about making sure that we're not contaminating the feedstocks that are ultimately going to go into a bag. But if you're taking that off of the curbside, or if you're taking that from anywhere where people are at, you're going to have contaminants. You're going to have trash. You're going to have God knows what. They put all kinds of stuff in there, So you got to be very careful about using that and putting it in a bag. So what is C&D? Well, I think everyone knows construction demolition material, dimensional lumber, pallets, untreated construction scraps, drywall, plastics, insulation, roofing, treated lumber, painted wood, adhesives, asbestos with older buildings, durable plastics, PVC, textiles. Most of that I can't use, right? I'm looking for a pre-consumer dimensional lumber is something that I can use. But it's increasingly, Sean's going to have some solutions, I think, that, like I said, I learned more than anybody, any of you are going to learn in this situation. But we've got to make sure and figure out how to feed the beast. And it's not going to be with exponential development going forward. So this is some old info. I conscripted some people to help me with this presentation. I just realized it was from 2018. But 6.7%. That's probably the ratio of what the wood products that would be considered C and D debris that are usable to me. Obviously, we can't use concrete. We can't use asphalt. We can use wood. So let's figure out how to sort it and get it usable and functional for sale. Diversification, alternative inbound streams as brush declines. Large C and D projects generate consistent material, and I think consistency is really the key here, because when you scale up to be able to co-pack for Scotts and Oldcastle or to go into the big box stores, you got to maintain that volume. And if you can't maintain that volume, you're in a bad way. And I can share with you that probably 5-6 years ago, between all of our sites, we maybe had, and these are ballpark figures, but let's call it 1 million cubic yards of first grind material that was available to us. Needed processing, but available to us. That number's probably a third of that right now. Maybe more. And that's concerning, because we know that every year, about this time of year when we start prepack, we're going to be consuming a lot of material. So, we've got to figure out how to, supplement our historical feedstocks with something else. So dimensional lumber, is definitely an option. Let's see here. External drivers. I mean, we've already talked about that. There's some risk associated with C&D material. So you've got, treated lumber, lead paint, glues. You've got some processing costs that, you know, collectively as a company of 200 or so people, we've got our systems in place, right? We know how to deal with brush. We know how to deal with first grind. So when you introduce other, feedstocks into that, the guys just aren't accustomed to it. So you may have some higher costs with sorting. You just got to pay more attention. And then there's a possibility for customer rejection if the mulch contains contaminants. Regulatory hurdles, TCQ limits on treated C&D and soil and mulch, and the need for clear standards from this organization, you know, help us figure it out. Percent of inbound pallets. You saw that we take in like less than 1% of dimensional lumber. So we need to figure that out. I've come to that realization trying to put this together. We have some pilot programs going with what that looks like and how we can do more of what Sean and Britton Industries are doing up in the Northeast, because in a lot of ways they're a crystal ball for us, because they're ahead of the curve on this. They've already gone through a lot of this. They don't have as much raw land to develop as Texas does. So I get this unique opportunity because of MSC to be able to lean on some of the things that they've already figured out. You know, they have some solutions to some of these problems, my problems. So what can we do? We can collect and share better data, like Sean and I have the past couple months. Pilot projects with C&D streams, engage regulators early, and encourage manufacturers to diversify into composting and specialized soil blends using municipal green waste. MSC's role, product purity standards, contamination thresholds, worker and consumer safety. Sustainability initiatives may drive eco-friendly sourcing. How can MSC support the industry? Guidance on best practices, advocacy with regulators, facilitation of industry data sharing, and then support adoption of TCQ for us, that's the Texas Commission of Environmental Quality, recycled materials initiative to reduce pressure on brush-derived feedstock. Key takeaways of the brush supply stability is not guaranteed, as far as when it comes to field grinding and clearing. C&D offers opportunity and risk. Industry must engage regulators proactively. But how do we balance availability with quality? What role should regulators play? And how can MSC support this adaptation? So I'm going to hand it over to Sean for what he has to say, and then I think we'll probably have time for questions at the end. But that's all I have for you now.
See if I can figure this out.
Nope.
Bob?
What am I hitting now?
One more time. Three things.
Nope. You went back to his.
No.
Now we got to get to that one.
Keep going one time.
Ah. Okay. Good morning, everyone. Wow, that's loud. Now there's a little bit of pressure because I don't have all the answers by any means. But the biggest thing that we did, and I'm going to talk about, is diversify. I'll just go back a little bit about us. We've been in business for 38 years. We run 4 recycling centers, but we started where these guys were. We were land clearing contractors and opened a recycling center to deal with our waste. And that built, and what we started to figure out, which these guys did as well, is the product sales started outracing the clearing, and New Jersey is not Texas. We do not have the land volume that Texas does, nor does PA. So we pivoted quickly because the one thing that I think we're really good at is pivoting and embracing different ways of doing things. So we did that very quickly. You can see a little bit of what we up here about us. We do a little bit of bags compared to Scott's and some of these guys. We're a bulk supplier mostly. But we move a lot of bulk and we needed a lot of wood. We are very big on vertical integration, so we make our own colorant. We do a bunch of other stuff, but wood has always been an issue for us as well. Getting into New Jersey and Pennsylvania has been harder. We transitioned about 12 years ago out of clearing and getting away from traditional supply chains as much as we could. Not completely, but we did. Most guys in here probably are dependent on clearing wood coming in or logging waste, which we don't have any logging waste in our area, really. So where were we going to get it? Like he said, there's a very it's unpredictable. Clearing is, and typical supply chains due to weather and also due to economy. I mean, we've been through the building slowdowns where clearing just stopped. And there was, where were we going to get wood? Because we still had orders to process and customers don't want to hear you don't have it. So we started going through a couple different things. We were looking for closer wood so that we didn't have the trucking because none of us, while all of us don't want to admit it, logistics is the biggest, probably, cost we have. We spend millions a year on logistics and getting product into our yards. And it really does cut into margins. So the more you can cut that down, the better off you are. I hear, like, talking to guys in the industry, you guys are going hundreds of miles for wood. We don't. Our max trip is about 50 miles one way. Now, part of that is also the geography, and where there's a very dense population in New Jersey and eastern Pennsylvania, which is the region that we're in. But, we used to go 70, 80 miles. If we had stayed in clearing, we knew long-term we were going to have to branch out into other states even farther away, and we just didn't think it was a viable alternative to do it. So we started looking for other sources that would control cost. We came up with new products that would allow us to get rid of some of the wood that we were bringing in. And then we looked at cheaper ways to process as well because we did realize we were going to have to do some traveling. So where did we go? Why did we diversify and how did we do it? We did it a couple different ways. We look for a variety of different types of wood now. Brush only makes up about 13% of what we bring in. We bring in about 25% wood chips and 25% grinds, and we get those from a variety of places, which I'll go into in a minute. Pallet wood makes up about 16 to 17% of what we grind now. We get pallet wood from a variety of different places, not just pallet companies. And a lot of you guys probably already have, and then everything else makes up a very small part of it. We do a lot of the freight. We got out of clearing, which was a big step for us. And I know Grant and I have talked about this. They're concerned, well, we don't have control of the wood waste anymore. We do, though, because we have trucks, so we still clear it up. We work with a lot of different land clearing companies in our region. and we clean up jobs for them, and that drives some of the waste that we have, but we're no longer bidding on the 20-acre job, the 15-acre job, because 100-acre jobs in New Jersey and PA come about once a year. There aren't big clearing jobs. It's not going to support the type of volumes that we do and a lot of people in this room do. So that's some of how we do it. Brush comes across our scales. We do get about 30% of our stuff from our four recycling facilities with landscapers coming in to dump. We also broadened our network on how we collected it. We just didn't limit it to tractor trailers. We have van trailers that we park at certain facilities where we take whole pallets from scrap places. A lot of you have relationships with Home Depot. We have a Home Depot warehouse 22 miles from our yard. It's one of the biggest suppliers we have of wood waste right now. They have a pallet company on site. They get rid of all the pallets from their warehouse by grinding it. We get single ground pallet wood that we park walking floors there and pull them out, and they pay us to take it. So it's actually a very, very cost-effective solution for us, and I know Home Depot has warehouses across the country. They have to get rid of that wood some way. The only thing you have to do, and the biggest concern with that stuff is, and I visit at the site every once in a while, is training them to keep the pallet wood clean before they grind it. That you're only taking pallet wood. You're not taking plywood mixed in with it. You're not taking trash and plastic. They're pretty good about it because we kind of demand it. When you start to move into this, the biggest thing you're going to face is quality control issues. And it took us a long time to get through it, but we just turn stuff away and don't take it. If they give us trash in a load, we send it back to them. And after a while, we pretty much hit a happy medium where our quality hasn't suffered. But it's taken a long time to do that. We put roll-off trucks out with our landscape companies because we do a lot of bulk material, so we do a lot of deliveries for them and drop the containers to backhaul yard waste. Again, same thing. You have to train your customers because you will get garbage in it if you don't. But they're pretty good about it. We give them an affordable solution to get rid of yard waste, which they have to do in New Jersey and Pennsylvania. And as a result, we end up getting stuff back. We have log trucks, grapple trucks, pretty much any way you can think of hauling wood, we're doing it at this point. Because we just don't have, we can't just go to sites and pick up wood. It will not support what we have. So where are we finding this stuff? I mean, the tree companies. We have programs with tree companies where they just dump their chips in their yard. When they get 20 to 30 loads, we'll go pick it up. And there are other people in our industry, in our area, doing the same thing now. We still work with a lot of traditional land clearers. We got out of it like 12 to 15 years ago and then started the transition of building partnerships with a lot of them, which took a while because they looked at us as a competitor. It's not an easy flip, but it can be done. But you really, the hard part is you can't dip your feet back in. If you tell these guys you're not going to clear and you're going to work with them and build partnerships, you can't decide later on, well, we're going to take this job. That doesn't work so well. So you have to really take the plunge and get out of that traditional. Now, we still do municipal grinding, but we don't do any clearing or field grinding outside of municipal contracts. We do a lot with municipal yards. We made a transition to that. There's a lot of municipalities in New Jersey that have yard waste problems. They have facilities, but they don't have the grinding capabilities to handle it. So we do bid a lot of that work. Pallet companies and warehouses are huge for us now. They make up a good portion of it. One of the things we did about 10 years ago is, I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with CHEP pallets. They're food pallets. They're blue and red. That is a water-based pigment. So if you're coloring mulch, you can literally take that. If we had to get approvals through the state of New Jersey, we work with regulators to do it. You can take food-based pallets because it's a water-based pigment, grind it, and color it. If you're doing coloring, it works with black. Not so much with red and blue, which means you have to have yard discipline to separate those pallets out for only the feedstock going into one colored mulch. But we have three CHEP sites that are tipping with us on a daily basis. So it's another study supply of wood stuff. The nice part with the pallet companies, Home Depot, CHEP, they're 365. They're not seasonal. They come in all year. Construction sites, we do a little bit. Like I said, we work with land clearing companies, but we don't do it anymore. And then we've gone after golf courses have become a big source of wood for us. Agriculture operations. We deal with two furniture manufacturers now. So we've really kind of spread out to whatever we could find where wood was coming. We made a conscious effort to do it. And it can be, so it can be done. The hard part, and I'll get into some of the challenges with it right now, quality control is probably the biggest one. We fight with it all the time. Our market is very, very mature. The mulch is extremely small, but the product is very small, but it has to be clean or they will not buy it. So our guys in our yards are clean. Our scale people who run, we have scales in every yard. They check every single load that comes in with cameras. And when we dump it, we have guys in every yard that pick trash. So we end up getting wood in, but the cost that we had from other things is now being translated into quality control. There's no doubt about it. Processing equipment becomes a little different. Because we get so much in on, through our scale, and a lot of it is already processed in chip form or grind form, the amount of grinders we have. How many are you running now?
18 or 19.
Yeah, they're running 18 or 19. We're similar size. We run 3 Diamond Zs and four electric stationary systems. But we're processing about the same amount of wood because we're not taking the bigger stuff and we're not dealing with whole trees. So it's become a little bit easier on that end. So you start to pick up some savings that way. Educating people because there's still a stigma against pallet wood. There's still a stigma against yard waste. Guys don't want it in. I don't want anything with pallet wood. But at some point it becomes unavoidable because there's just not the tree waste available in a market that's as dense as ours. New Jersey's not developing like they are anymore. The regulations to develop make it very, very difficult. The regulations to even run recycling centers in the two regions we're in make it very difficult. And then the logistics, you're managing multiple sources. I have our dispatch team and the logistics team pulls off miracles because they have van trailers going here. They have, walking floors going here, dump trailers, who needs what, when it needs to be there. And we've got a pretty good system in place, but it does make it more challenging. It's not just, okay, we're sending 20 trucks to this job to run all day to bring in wood waste. It's nice when it happens. It just doesn't happen all that often. So, I mean, and how do you do this? That's really probably the biggest thing. Start small. You know, you're not going to do this overnight. It takes a while to do some of this stuff. You have to assess and innovate all the time. We're constantly changing. We're constantly looking at different sources, how we can use stuff. We do a lot with local industries and municipalities. We're heavily involved. Our sales team is heavily involved with working with the municipalities. And we market sustainability. Everybody's, you know, there's such a negative connotation behind pallet wood because we separate pallet wood. I don't consider it C&D. C&D is a whole other animal, and we don't touch it. It's too hard to get it clean, so we stick with pallet wood and dimensional lumber. But we almost never get into C&D. But sustainability is a big push right now in the industry for a lot of different people. So when you can start to offer circular solutions to municipalities where you're taking material from them, processing it, and giving it back to them, most of them will buy into that and like that and work with you on it. Same thing with marketing it to your consumers in general. You know, I'd like to say we could do everything with green waste going forward, but that's not going to happen, especially as the markets develop. And it's taken us a while to get there. There's no doubt about it. And we're still struggling with it. Wood is still a struggle for us every single day. I mean, it goes back and forth. There are times in the season where we have more than we know what to do with and times where We don't have enough, and managing your wood stream just is probably an all-day or a full-time job. We have two guys who do nothing but hunt wood, basically. That's all they do for whatever way. And our sales team knows that their job is to bring in wood as well. From a cost perspective, I'm trying to think. I mean, processed wood is really easy. If you get a single process, there's already a cost that someone already did for you on that. And raw wood, we're still doing all right with. So that's basically what we figured out within the industry is you're going to have to look for multiple sizes, multiple places to get it. There's no single stream of material anymore that's going to feed most of the guys in the kind of volume you're using. So that's it. Thanks, guys.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you. I think my challenge in the metro areas in Texas are that there's not a lot of mills close to Austin. And so that the freight just kills us on that. DFW is more of a possibility because there's more forestry and mills out that way, and also Houston. But I'll ask, if you'll speak to this, you got a mill. I mean, are they building more mills or are they not? Yeah. Yeah. I think you're spot on. I think for us it's a freight issue because freight has such an impact on our business, but Sean may have.
We don't really have. We unfortunately, I'd love to, but we really don't have many mills nearby. The Northeast isn't really loaded with lumber mills that are fairly close. I think there's two or three.
That's the thing, right?
Yeah.
Having shipped product 300 miles. So they went to the product and set up their operation there on site, partnered with the engineers, to save that freight cost would come and kill them, then process it and send it back out. They would process on site.
Right.
Yeah.
coming to visit you next. I got a lot of questions for you.
Another question? How much of that, Jim, how much of that wood waste is? How much is that providing of your wood waste?
So we want to keep it perpetual. We don't want to just harvest it all in 1 year. So the most we'll harvest in a year is 100 acres. But some years we don't harvest any at all. So, but we process about, well, we consume about 25,000 tons of biosolids a year. We dig a trench 6 feet deep, 4 feet wide. We put 4 feet of biosolids in the trench, cover it with 2 feet of dirt, and plant the trees over top. It takes 7 to 10 years to get a harvest. The oldest trees we have right now on the property are 13 years old. They're 55, 60 feet tall.
Wow. That is impressive.
And it makes them very pretty.
Any other questions? Sean?
Walking floors?
What was the question?
40? How many walking floors do we run? We own about 40. We're probably running on the road and on a given day about 20 in this time of year, 60 to 100 in season when we're delivering to.
Depends for us. I mean, it can be 20, it can be 40. We sub out. We used to own all of our trucks. We sub out more now, but it fluctuates.
Any further questions? Great questions and comments.
The unfortunate part is I wish.
Yeah.
The truth is, no, it's guys pulling it off when it comes into the yard.
Okay. The idea is to grab it, pull it out.
The idea is to get the customers to take it off before they put it in the truck for you, which is we do a bunch of that to make sure that it I mean, we're pretty tough on them. We stay on top of them. We'll backcharge them for labor costs if we have to. And inevitably, we still end up doing some of it.
Any more questions? Great. Thank you, Sean and Grant, for sharing your valuable expertise. Awesome. Awesome. We'll now have a break from 10 o'clock to 10:30. We'll be back here at 10:30 for our next session. Leveraging screening methods for cost savings and quality control.